for coming. This is truly an honor for us to host Scott Murphy, our congressman for New York's 20th district. From both sides of the political spectrum, from either end, for coming. This is truly a bipartisan event. And we thank everybody for coming here. Everybody, absolutely everybody. Scott's 100th day in Congress just passed, and we're here to listen to the progress report, hear some of the things he's doing. I'm sure he's going to be talking about healthcare, which is something that's on everybody's mind. And we're going to talk, we're just going to listen and then ask questions. And thank you very much, Congressman Murphy.
Derek, thank you very much for having us here today and for the inconvenience to your business. So I guess I should do the commercial message first. Please shop at Golden Harvest, support our local farmers. An effective part of our stimulus effort to get this economy moving again if everybody buys some of our local apples here while they're here today. So I want to echo Derek's thanks to people for coming out. I had a town hall meeting yesterday in Granville up in the corner of our district where people thought there'd be 30 people. 130 people showed up. We had a great discussion. At the end, I'll ask you all a question about, you know, what you think the right solution to do is with a whole range of options. And what I found is that 20% of the people liked all the options, which is what makes my job fascinating and fun, because I only get one vote. At the end of the day, I have to vote yes or no on each individual piece of legislation. So getting your input is critical. To me, this is what is fundamental about America. The fact that people can come out and talk to their local elected officials and their federal officials about their beliefs, share what they think, protest when they're upset, say yes when they support it. And this is what motivated me to get involved in politics and government, is the ability of people in this country to be involved in this kind of debate. And I'm so proud of the people of the 20th District of New York that we can come together and have these kind of conversations, have a microphone so that people can hear. When we let, at the end of my comments, we'll have you making comments and asking questions, and we'll have people with a microphone so everyone can hear. And I'm also very excited. One thing I don't want to forget to do is introduce my family. It's a Saturday, so I bring them. Our general rule my wife and I came up with is on Saturday campaigning and governing events, if I can't be with the family, I'll bring them with me. So I've got my my son Duke here with me.
All right.
My daughter Lux. My daughter Snow. Her friend Emma. And my two nieces, Danielle and Jessica. Their parents went away for their mom's 50th birthday, and we got to keep them for the weekend. You may know that I have a big family, so it's not uncommon on weekends that we've got more than just my three kids hanging out at our house. I also want to say thanks to my wife, Jen, who's here with me today. So let me tell you a little bit about the first 100 days. It's been very busy in Washington. So I got elected. We were running this campaign during what was quite possibly the scariest economic times any of us have faced in our lifetime. Very real concern that we might see this country slip into another Great Depression. We saw a lot of action, a lot of efforts to do that. We lowered interest rates on monetary policy. I supported the fiscal stimulus as part of the way to avoid going into The good news is that I think our economy is in a much better place today than it was 6 months ago. We are now. We are not in a good place. We are in the middle of a very, very deep and painful recession. But I believe that we are in a better place than we were 6 months ago. Our financial system is not on the verge of collapse. And hopefully, we're starting to see some signs that we're coming out of the bottom. We are by no means in a good place, and don't let anyone misinterpret that. We are still losing jobs. We've got high unemployment. We've got a lot of work for our small businesses to do. That's been part That's been part of what I've been working on during my time in office. We've been working on getting stuff started here in the 20th District and around the country. And I'm very excited that some of the stuff we've been able to do to help our small businesses. I was a small business owner, and working with small businesses before I did this, that's where we create jobs. That's how we grow our economy. The SBA loan programs, the SBA has been working hard to get money out to our small businesses, our small farmers. We just are about to launch a new store in downtown Glens Falls that we were able to be helpful in starting up, getting them an SBA loan for the chocolate shop. I was just down with Local Ocean, a local aquaculture company here in Columbia County earlier this week, helping them get through some of the regulatory hurdles to start their fish farm. I was up in Malta at the official groundbreaking for the new Global Foundries plant, where we're going to have several thousand construction jobs leading to over 1,000 manufacturing jobs in the world's most advanced semiconductor plant here in our district. So part of what we've been working on is economic development and economic recovery issues, which are close to my heart because those are the kinds of small business projects I've been working on for a long time. A few other things that have been going on in the first 100 days. We had credit card reform bill. So many of the small business owners in the district came to me during the campaign saying, you know, I'm paying my bills from my credit card where I fund my business. The interest rates are jumping from 8% to 25%. It's crazy. Why are they doing this to me? We put in reform that we passed in Congress to make it so that if you're paying your bill on time, that they can't arbitrarily change your interest rate while you're trying to pay off that credit card bill. I think that's good reform for our consumers and for our small businesses. We also passed mortgage reform, which said the mortgage problem, the mortgage industry was a big part of what happened with this housing bubble, and we needed to change that dynamic. Too many people in that business were writing loans for houses that were selling at prices that they couldn't appraise at, for people that couldn't afford to buy them, and then selling the loan the next day, making a profit, washing their hands and walking away. That's not the way you develop a strong community. So we passed a law.
Okay.
Hey, everybody will have a chance to ask their questions and make their comments. We passed a law that I thought was common sense. Anybody that makes a loan has to hold 5% of the loan. You can sell off 95%. I think that part of the financial system works, but I want the people making the loan, just like the local banks in Glens Falls and Saratoga Springs and all across this district that ran their business in a traditional way, to have some skin in the game so that they care whether or not the borrower can afford that house and whether or not that price was reasonable, and they're going to be a partner for 30 years along with you trying to pay off your mortgage and make sure your house is sturdy and stable. So that's some of the stuff we worked on. We've also been working, I'm on the Armed Services Committee and I'm on the Agriculture Committee. So in the armed services world, we've been working on getting a defense budget passed. Working on
the troops home now.
Bring them home.
Okay, again, everybody will have a chance to talk. Working on getting a supplemental budget to make sure that our troops have the dollars they need as we're drawing down in Iraq, and as the president has decided, ramping up in Afghanistan. We made sure that they had the money they needed to do that. But at the same time, I got involved in fighting to make sure that we weren't wasting money in the defense budget. A lot of you have heard about this F-22 battle. The Defense Department came to Congress, the President and the Defense Department said, we have enough F-22s. We don't need to buy any more. But members of Congress who have F-22s in their district wanted to keep making more and asked for $350 million in the House to build more airplanes that the Defense Department said they didn't need. I voted no on that because it was the wrong thing to do.
Get rid of those two.
How about Nancy Pelosi getting a new plane?
I'll address another question. Another question was asked about the defense appropriation bill that just recently passed. In that bill, there was funding for three private jets for members of Congress and other officials of government to use for travel. That was passed in the defense appropriations bill. There was not an opportunity to vote on that amendment. That didn't come through my committee. It was in the main bill on the floor. We were not allowed to have an amendment to take that out. I thought it was ridiculous. We shouldn't have bought those planes.
Thank you!
And I can tell you that as the most junior member of Congress, nobody's offered me a ride on a government plane.
I'm flying on Southwest
in the back with everybody else to fly down to Washington to do my work. We shouldn't have done that, and I would have been able, if I could have voted against that, I would have. I voted for the bill in its entirety. They were buried in the whole $600 billion defense bill, which I did vote for because that was all of our funding for all of our military. That's a lesson in how this works. You don't get to, in my job, vote on every line of each bill, which is a very frustrating part of the job. So there are things, and I'll tell you this about health, there are things that I'm going to hate and things that I'm going to love. That's unfortunately the job that I have. Let me ask one more thing about my 100 days. If people will hold, we're trying to have a good conversation, and I know I'm talking too long, but I wanted to give you a little bit of range of things we're doing, and then we'll talk healthcare, which I know is what a lot of people are here for. So the last thing that I've been spending a lot of time on is the House Agriculture Committee, where I serve, and in particular the dairy crisis that we're facing all over New York and all over this country. For those of you who aren't closely involved, the price per hundredweight of milk was $22 a year ago. It's $12 now and has been $10 to $12 for the last 7 months. Every dairy farm in America is losing money right now, and we're going to lose a lot of our farms. A lot of them are going to go out of business if that doesn't get fixed. Now, a lot of people will say the answer to that is, you know, price supports, just pour more money into solving that. I think that is a part of a short-term solution. The MILC program is a way to help our small farmers in the short term. I have introduced legislation just a couple weeks ago to double the payment under that program during the course of this year as a short-term help to keep our farmers in business. But the fundamental solution, in my mind, is to let the market work. I'm a business guy. Let the prices come back. The farmers, together with their cooperatives, have a program called CWT to remove cattle from the herd. In this time, the recession, people are buying less milk overseas, we're exporting less milk. We only need about 9 million head of cattle to supply our needs. We have, at the beginning of this year, we had 9.6 million in the herd nationwide. The CWT program has been slowly reducing that. We're down to about 9.2. The CWT program just did another round of asking farmers that wanted to shut down and sell off their herds. We'll be down to about 9.1. In my legislation, I asked for federal money to help accelerate that process to buy the last 100,000 head of cattle from people who are willing to retire or go out of the business and sell their herd, and then get us back into balance so the market can bring those prices back to balance and we can have a dairy industry that's healthy and strong and vibrant here in our community in upstate New York. So that's been something I've been working on a lot. Now, in the last month, we've been working on healthcare. This has become the issue that everybody in Congress is focused on, and I think so many people here are focused on. So let me give people a little bit of an update on where we are, because it's very, very confusing to watch in the press. The way the process works in the House and the Senate is that individuals introduce bills, committees develop bills, and pass those bills to the whole House or the whole Senate. That's the process, and then it goes from one House, either the House, over to the Senate or vice versa. What we've done in the House is there's a bill called H.R. 3200, which is the big health care plan in the House. It's been assigned to three committees, Energy and Commerce, Education and Labor, Ways and Means, to deal with different parts of it. Each of those three committees has changed the bill and then passed it out of their committee. So there are now three bills in the House that are waiting to come to the floor. The Senate has two committees working on bills. One in the Education and Labor Committee has passed a bill. The other, the Finance Committee, and the Max Baucus, you may have seen his name, is working on a bipartisan bill that hasn't been even shown to people yet. They're still just working on it. So there are effectively five different bills in various places in the process in either the House or the Senate. So I will talk some about the basic House bill that we started with before it was amended, so people know what I'm talking about. And I'll talk a lot about my thoughts at this point on what we should do with our healthcare system based on the feedback I'm getting from people. And at the end of today, I'll have slightly different thoughts based on the feedback I get from you. But here's what I believe. The United States is able to provide the best healthcare in the world for those that are afford to pay or have good enough insurance to pay for it. People travel here from all over the world to get the most advanced and best procedures. At the same time, the United States has some group of people, 40 or 50 million people, who don't have a health insurance plan. Okay. I promise that everybody will have a chance, or a long line of people have a chance to come up with, to express their own opinions.
I think
some of the questions were, there are people that say maybe there aren't that many people without health insurance here. I have not counted them personally, but I do know people in my life that don't have health insurance. So I know that there are some. Those are numbers that experts have given us. Could the number be smaller or larger? Absolutely. But there's a big number of people that don't have a health insurance plan right now who don't get the kind of world-class care that some people do get in this country. So we have a range. And so people know, we also have a system where we have said to our doctors and hospitals that you have to treat people if they come in. We as a society have decided we will not let you bleed to death on the street. If you get to the hospital or if somebody sees you, the ambulance will take you to the hospital, and our hospitals are required to take care of you. If you can't pay, they deal with that. It's called uncompensated care. They have to pass that cost on to those of us who have health insurance plans. The estimates are that if anybody here has a family plan, between $1,000 and $2,000 a year of your money is going to pay for uncompensated care for all the people who don't have health insurance plans and don't pay their bills at the hospital or the doctor. That, I think, is part of the problem, is that people who have insurance pay too much, and people who don't have insurance aren't in the system and don't get as much care as they could otherwise. So those are some of the high-level things. What do I think we should be doing to make a system that's better than what we have now? I believe if we're going to do healthcare reform, and I think there's some important reasons that we should do healthcare reform, we should follow these principles. Choice. It's a fundamental American value. There's a reason that so many people can come here. There's a reason that we have the right to keep and bear arms. There's a reason we have a right to protest. There's a reason we have a right not to be unreasonably searched and our property seized by our government. We have a Bill of Rights that is a fundamental part of how we as Americans see ourselves and how we have chosen to govern ourselves. And so much of that is about individual choices and individual freedoms. I believe that individuals should have the right to choose to keep their health plan they have now if they want to. I believe they should also have the right to choose some other health plan if they want to. That is a fundamental part of any reform that I would be supporting. And while people have said this is not true, as I have read and studied and understand health care, the 3200 bill, the original bill that was introduced, that is a core tenet of what is going on there. There are many nuances around that, but that is a core piece of the structure that we're talking about in the House plan. So choice is very important. The next piece, in my opinion, is that we need everybody, if we have decided as a society that we won't let you bleed to death and we're going to make our hospitals take care of you, I believe that we should require everybody to have some kind of basic insurance plan, just like you have to have an auto insurance plan. So, absolutely. So, much like we say you must have auto insurance in case you're on the road and get hurt or hurt someone else, we're going to say we are going to protect you if you get sick. You have to have a basic plan. But I believe fundamentally, if we're going to require that people have some kind of insurance, they have to have choices in what they are going to pick for their insurance. That's where, in my opinion, the choice comes in. So we are saying at some level, there is a requirement for people to have some basic insurance, but at another level, that they get to choose what that insurance looks like. That's how I think it should work. Let me finish with some principles. Most importantly, in all of the conversation, though, that's where we get into the arguments, but the part that is most important, in my opinion, is making health care and health insurance affordable for every American. Everybody that I talk to struggles with the cost, struggles with the cost of their health insurance plan, and so many of the people that I know who don't have insurance don't have it primarily because it costs too much money. It's not that they don't want insurance, it's that they can't afford insurance. And I believe...
That's
absolutely. And that is... So the gentleman was asking about choices. Anyway, so I believe that's the principles of what I want to work on. Now, how do we make it more affordable? There are dozens of things that we can do within our health insurance system and our health care system to make it more affordable for everyone without sacrificing the quality of care we have. Let me talk about a few. One, administrative reform with respect to billing and policies and procedures. Every health insurance company, I believe, should use the same forms and the same codes so that the doctors and hospitals don't have to have fleets of people working in their billing department and don't have to spend their life chasing bills, but rather can focus on taking care of patients. When I talk to doctors and hospitals, this is a huge frustration in their life, dealing with this. One of the healthcare groups in my district, which has a bunch of locations in rural areas and struggles to keep doctors and provide care there, says they have to send bills to 1,248 different locations to get paid. We can force that to be simpler with standard administrative procedures that will help everybody. That's a real problem. Next thing on my list, this list is really long. Another huge thing that we can do that will dramatically improve medical care in our area and our ability to get doctors is a fundamental rewrite of the Medicare reimbursement formula. Right now, Congress sets the Medicare reimbursement formula, and most private insurance companies follow it. And they set it county by county, and it's a highly political process. There is an amendment, which I support, to say we're going to have a National Institute of Health do a nationwide study of what it actually costs to run a medical practice in different areas and set the Medicare reimbursement rates, which right now are a hodgepodge, set them nationwide to be fair and equitable to all our doctors, and the doctors in rural areas like ours will end up getting more relative to what they get in some areas now. That's one of the key reasons that we aren't able to recruit as many doctors into our communities, because they can get paid more for doing the same work in other places that have won the political battle. Now I'll tell you, people will find this maybe frightening, maybe interesting. When I start getting in this argument in Washington and say, look, some places get reimbursed more than they need, some communities like ours get reimbursed less, we need to balance that. People say, okay, well, we'll give you guys some more money if you'll vote for the bill.
That's government health care.
That is the wrong way to approach this problem. Our health care system is really expensive. We need to shift that money around. We don't need to spend more money on that reimbursement rate. We need to shift it around to be fair to everyone. So the Medicare reimbursement rate is something that is set by Congress right now, and that is where that comes from. And the idea with this amendment would be that the study would come back to Congress and we would have to vote yes or no, and not be able to play partisan politics or any other kind of politics with how these numbers work. Yeah. Sure. No, not that one. Those are a couple of ideas. People clearly, I could go on forever with reform ideas. There are a lot of, let me give one more big one. Right now our system, this is as a business person, our system is fundamentally set up to drive doctors and hospitals to see you as quickly as they can and push you on to the next patient. The doctor spends 10 minutes with you no matter what you need, because the system says they have 15 minutes and they get to bill $40 or $20 or whatever it is for that. The system is driven towards transaction volume instead of towards making you well. And one of the things that we're talking about is moving the Medicare reimbursement model to value pricing and say, if you're sick with this disease, the doctor gets this much money. They can spend as much or as little time with you as they want. They can get back to, their goal is to make you well, instead of just from a business perspective to run their business, just have to see X number of people in every day. That's one of the problems that doctors have with the system. It's one of the reasons that the system doesn't work well for patients either. That's fundamental reform that shouldn't be costing more money. It should cost less money, and it should make it so that doctors and patients are now working to get well. No, that's not rationing. That's called giving the doctor the opportunity to spend as much or as little time with you as they want. That's the way that we want it to work. That's what we want to have, is the doctor getting paid for helping you get well, and you, because that's what you want when you come in as well. One other thing about insurance reform that we're talking about that I think there's a lot of people are excited about and working on is getting rid of pre-existing condition exclusions for insurance companies. in the process of rescission. The other part of that is the process of rescission, whereby a healthcare company can come to you 3 years after you sign up and say, well, there was this test you had 8 years ago that might have indicated you had something, and we're not going to cover this disease because it was a pre-existing condition. We're going to make it illegal to do that so that everybody can get into our healthcare system. Let me back up and be more precise. I'm in favor of doing that. Well, I said we're going to do that. I don't know what we're going to do in Washington, but I'm in favor of doing that as part of fundamental health reform. So, that is absolutely, I'll vote against Pelosi. I ride and coach. Somebody was asking me if I'll vote against Nancy Pelosi. Some of you saw these stories. It was maybe my second week that I was there. There was a bill introduced by Jeff Flake, a Republican from Arizona, to have a House ethics investigation of the PMA scandal. What was going on with respect to this company, PMA, that was making contributions and helping people get defense appropriations. There was a lot of talk about this. There was a lot of stuff in the press how the Democratic leadership in the House didn't want members to vote for this investigation. They wanted to protect members from being investigated, and that there was email going around saying, you better vote for this. And this was, it may have been my second week or third week. I voted along with a handful of other Democrats in favor of the investigation because it was the right thing to do. And I'm not going to vote with anybody because they have some job or some title. I'm going to agree with Nancy Pelosi a lot of the time because I vote on hundreds and hundreds of things. And I'm going to disagree with her a lot of the time. And the same thing with Republicans and anybody else. We don't happen to have any independents in the House, but I'll agree with them sometimes and disagree with them because I have to make up my own decisions based on what I hear from you and my experiences in the world and what I think is best for our district and our country. So with that, and the overwhelming consensus we've built, let's start having some questions and answers. And so why don't we try to organize this? Want to do a line? So to try to make this a little calmer than me just picking people out, we're going to form a line down this side of the building. So people can come over, then get a line, then they'll be able to talk at the microphone so you can hear, and then I can talk at the microphone so you can hear me. And again, while we're getting the line organized, let me just say thank you so much to everybody for being here, for taking the time to listen, and for being willing to engage in our democracy in a way where people can hear and can debate and can have a chance to hear the answers. One of my staff members wanted me to be sure to mention something that we'll probably get a bunch of questions about in case we don't. And this, I think, is if everybody could hold down in just a second. This is a story I want to share. I had a group of protesters outside my office at Saratoga Springs a few weeks ago who were very concerned about federal spending and in particular about the power of the Federal Reserve, saying, hey, we need to audit the Fed. And so they were there and they were complaining about that, and they asked me about it, and I said, well, my understanding is the Fed is audited, but I'll check into it. I did some more checking. The Fed is audited, but there are exclusions on a bunch of important areas that actually can't be audited. They had shared that detail with me. I went and investigated it, understood that that was true, and then I signed on about a month ago as a co-sponsor of the bill to require an independent audit of the entirety of the Fed. So that is exactly what we're here today to do, and hopefully we're going to come up with ideas today that I can take back and fight to get in legislation in Congress to make the country and our healthcare system and the whole rest of our government a better and more functioning thing. So with that, who's going to come on up?
Hi, I'm Laura Davidson, and I'm from Relations. I'm about a mile away from here. Congressman Murphy, first of all, thank you for coming today and being here to discuss with us. My question is about the health care reform bill, H.R. 3200.
Can you speak up?
Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. I see signs here today for a public option, and I see signs here today for no government takeover. I myself am very happy with my health insurance, and I want to be certain that nobody will do anything to take away my choice. So because I like to get to the truth, I read the bill, and here's my question. There's a section in the bill on pages 16 through 19, and I know it's not passed, but this is what's in there today, and it's about grandfathering private health insurance plans. And what it says is that the day the bill is enacted, no private insurance company will be able to, with a plan existing, nobody will be able to enroll new subscribers to that plan. That seems like a funnel, for because if you move, change jobs, whatever, that's going to funnel me to the government, and that's not what I want. So can you please speak to that and tell me how I'm going to keep my choice?
That is a very, very good question, an important point that I think a lot of people have angst and confusion about. So let me walk through. I didn't get into the plan that's in the healthcare bill 3200, but let me just walk through it at a high level for people. Over here, if you have an employer-based plan, you can keep that employer-based plan. That's the employer-based plan. Now, there's one nuance to that. We're talking about having kind of a minimum level of a plan. Just like with car insurance, your insurance plan has to meet a minimum level. A very tiny number, you know, a percent or two of plans that are out there today don't have that minimum care. And the bill says over 5 years,